Okay, and I would like to introduce our next speaker. He serves Alcoholics Anonymous as a staff worker in the General Service Office in New York and is responsible for our AA website. And he will be sharing on his experience with the General Service Office, Clement C. So thanks so much, Clement.
Well, how many people are ready for a good old-fashioned face-to-face AA story? Anybody? My name's Clement. I'm an alcoholic. I have the pleasure of currently serving as your communication services coordinator at GSO. And I have to say, just to put everything in context, at GSO, it's the next person up on your staff. So I wasn't selected because I had any special technical abilities. I was selected to follow directions, to do what I was asked to do, to have an open mind, to be willing to go to any lengths to try to carry out what our fellowship wants to happen. So I just want to make that plain. Before I get started, because I don't have a technical presentation. A gentleman asked me if I had a PowerPoint. No, I don't have a PowerPoint. I have a point of power. How about that? Once again, I have a sobriety date. It's September 9th, 1991. So I'll have an opportunity to participate in my 26th anniversary here at the workshop tomorrow. So if I make it, if I stay sober, right? I'd like to thank Cindy. I got a chance to meet her earlier today. We've talked on the telephone back and forth, and we were trying to decide, you know, exactly what I would do. And I told her all I could do is what I know to do, and that's to share my story. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not here with my iPad and my pen and paper to try to get as much information as I can get and glean from the participants of the conference about what you want to see happen. I do have an open mind, and I am willing. And I am willing to carry what I hear back to the website committee, which I'm the chair of. I'm also the chair of the website design committee. I'm secretary for technology communication services on the AAWS board. David is a member. And I've heard a lot of really positive things today. Not all of them have been brand new, but all of them are definitely worthy of consideration. And I want you just to be aware of the fact that people are listening. It's not decisions being made or decisions coming from on high to, you know, create the future for Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's organizations like this of concerned AA members that come together to share their experience, strength, and hope that make the future. So hopefully over the weekend we'll have the opportunity to communicate. Any ideas that you have, I have some cards with all my contact information. So any ideas that you have now, please share. Any ideas that you have in the future, you'll have the ability to share. So with that, I have a sponsor. I have a home group. It's the St. Nicholas Group in Harlem, New York. 3 years ago, I had to leave Area 38, which was the area where I got sober. Several members are here today. I got the opportunity to see and moved to New York to try to serve. I had at the time, my sponsor was very involved in service. And it was through following his directions that I ended up standing before you today. Because one of his directions was, whenever you go to New York, always visit GSO. So the next time you visit, you stand in danger of ending up where I am today. So be careful. Because it's that time of year, it just makes me think of what it was like for me 26 years ago. And it wasn't a pretty sight. I grew up in St. Louis, and as I was growing up, I mean, basically the city was totally segregated, as it is now. My neighborhood was made up of a lot of large families, and my sponsor always would point out to me that it was my mother's desire to try to provide for me, that she dressed me in these little outfits, and like I might have on a plaid shirt, and if you turned up the cuffs of my blue jeans, the cuffs would match my shirt. Now, this wasn't a fashion statement in my neighborhood. Plus, I was what they called at the time pigeon-toed. So I had these corrective shoes with soles about that thick. Now, this is before thick soles were a fashion statement. So you can believe I took a lot of grief as I was growing up. Plus, I was an only child. You know, I lived in a house with two aunts and my mother and my grandmother. So I had it tough. And we had the opportunity to move because of eminent domain. The city built a school where our house was, so we moved to the suburbs. And my mother would let me come back to the old neighborhood on the weekends just to hang out, visit old friends. And on one of those, it was early spring is all I can remember. I don't know why, but some of the guys made a decision to let's get some alcohol. And being the connoisseurs that we were, pineapple wine of the highest vintage was selected. And, you know, I made the transformation from Urkel into one of the Temptations or Miracles almost instantly, you know? And we went to a party at one of the local schools, and, you know, I was on Michigan State's basketball team. I was the coolest person ever, you know, and I was 13 years old, that magic age in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was just like somebody took a hot branding iron and branded me with the idea that I had found a living solution to the living problem that I had been having for the first 13 years, you know? That's why I think it was so difficult 26 years ago to convince me that I had a problem with alcohol, because alcohol was always my solution. Some people say, well, I started drinking and, you know, my life just collapsed. Well, mine didn't collapse. I was a student representative on the board of education. I was captain of the basketball team. I was a straight-A student. I got an academic scholarship to Harvard and several other Ivy League schools. And it just seemed like I had it together. You know, in some of the conversations I had with my mother before she passed, she'd always say, well, it always seemed like you had it, you know, that you did have it together. And I thought you were just going through a phase. And nobody could have guessed the phase was going to last 26 years, you know. But it did. And it didn't happen to me all at once, but it happened so gradually that I never saw it happening. You know, I'm sure other people did, but I could never see that. And when I was in college, one of my main character defects that I began to demonstrate was isolation. You know, being a young, black, rebellious student at Harvard, you're talking about feeling apart from. I felt about as apart from that community as you could possibly feel, which fueled my isolation. And I always, you know, I started to develop that alcoholic characteristic if I had to be right. And if I got in a discussion with you and I couldn't make you yield to my will at that time, I would go back to my room, pull the Tanqueray off the shelf, and begin to reload. You know, that was my thought. I had to find a way to prove that I was right about whatever the discussion was, whether it was my girlfriend, whether it was a friend, whether it was somebody in the class, whatever. It didn't matter. It was always my way or the highway. And that was, you know, that was my perspective when I was in college. And I graduated, and I thought to myself, well, I've been doing the school thing so rigorously for however many years, it's time for me to take some time off. So I've always loved the arts. I had some friends from St. Louis who had gone to Europe in, I guess it was 72 or 73, and they, two of them had returned to New York and had remained. So I decided that, you know, I'd join them. And really what happened was, you know, in my mind, I was going to turn the New York art scene on its ear. But all that really happened was I added narcotics to my story. And I'll leave that there. If anybody would like to discuss that further, you can catch me in the hallway. But it started for me a series of geographics, back and forth, because the problem was never me. The problem was always where I lived or who I was dealing with, or, you know, many other social ills and problems I considered to be the problem. But never could I look inside to see that the problem was actually me. So I did a number of geographics. The best thing that happened out of those geographics was I met my current wife. She was actually doing a field study in New York in theater, and she claims to this day she lost her airline ticket to fly back to St. Louis, so I eventually, on one of my geographics, ended up driving her back. And one thing led to another. That summer, after I drove her back to St. Louis, she showed up at my door on my birthday with a fifth of Tanqueray. And the rest is history. I'm proud to say she's a member of that group of folks. They sometimes go into the acronym of AFG. Proud member. She got sane before I got sober. I'd just like to acknowledge that. She's upstairs. She's still hanging in there. It's 42 years later, and we're still, you know, moving along. But, you know, it for me, the alcoholism just continued to grow. I had some of my darkest years. We were living on 3rd Avenue. That's the summer of 1984. It was probably one of the darkest times of my life. I mean, I had sold everything in the house. It was just a mess. And like any good alcoholic, I got on the phone, called Mom. Mom said she'd, you know, provide an airline ticket, and she did. And, you know, my current wife, we had a big blowout, and I went back to St. Louis. And as my mother and I sat in the kitchen that night talking, I got up and I went and looked in the food pantry. And in the pantry, she had half gallons of almost every kind of alcohol that you could think of. And, my mother doesn't drink, but she's the kind of hostess that she wants to have whatever it is that you drink. In all truthfulness, I never thought alcohol was my problem. I thought drugs was my problem. So I thought, well, how handy. This will help take a little of the edge off. And one thing led to another, and what started off as a 1 or 2 week visit home ended up as a 30-year visit home. I eventually was able to, pull my wife back to St. Louis. The Egyptians have a saying that some people can fall in the river and come out with a fish in their mouths. And that has been my experience in my life. I was able to get a great job working for a local corporation as a writer-producer. My background was in filmmaking at the time, and I got involved in corporate video. And it was, in and of itself, it seemed like this was the solution. I was going to finally step up and be a man, you know. This was actually the time my wife and I got married. We got the house, we got the new car, you know, and in my mind, surely this was the solution to all the living problems that I was having. But needless to say, as you all know, that didn't happen. What did happen was a psychiatrist ended up putting me on naltrexone and antabuse. And I'm here to let you know antabuse does work. but it was one of the... really one of the darkest times of my life. It taught me a lesson that I was able to transfer to my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is alcohol is not my problem. Because during that time of a chemical straitjacket that I was wearing, I was as angry as a person could possibly be. You know, I mean, it was just... it's hard to even express. I guess the best way to really talk about it is one day my wife walked up to me and just said, you know what, you need to stop taking the antabuse and just go back to drinking. You know, because from her perspective, and I believe my wife loves me, but from her perspective, that was the best solution for me because I couldn't cope with life without my solution, which was alcohol at the time. And I tried many things. At one point, I was hospitalized for 30 days in an effort to just detox me. They wouldn't even let me in the treatment center. And eventually, you know, my wife, this is around the time that she got involved with Al-Anon. Actually, when she had seen in a newspaper ad, if your loved one has a problem with alcohol, write to this address. She wrote to the address. The first thing that she saw in the letter was detachment. And she was like, detachment? I love him. This is my husband. So she brought it up, threw it in the waste can. Well, she found that group again. And I think her sponsor told her, don't do anything drastic for 6 months. And probably it was 6 months in one day when she said, I'm out of here. And walked out the door of that house and left that car and left everything. And my response was, wonderful. You know, I got right on the phone and called my friends. Come on over. She's gone. And it was all great until I started hitting switches and nothing was coming on. Started getting kind of chilly around the house. You know, seasons were changing and nothing was working. Being the alcoholic that I was, I packed up my little plastic stereo and everything in the house that couldn't be sold, and I went back to Mom's house. And here, you know, the great artist, the filmmaker that was going to turn New York on its ear, I'm back at Mom's house. I used to say my house. Laying in the little room I grew up in with clown pictures and cowboy pictures and everything still on the wall, you know, and I'm about 6'3", and it was one of those, I think they call them full beds, but my feet were, I mean, you know, my legs and everything were extended beyond the edge of the bed by about 2 or 3 feet. So here I find myself. And the book talks about, you know, that point of incomprehensible demoralization, and that's where I found myself. I had finances because the job had given me a severance package I didn't deserve, but they were anxious to give me away. You know, and that one job at one time, in one calendar year, I missed 57 days. So you can imagine how many relatives died and everything else in order to get all that cleared up. But they were anxious to get me off the books, and they did. And I thank them for it. So at this point, they did let me in the treatment center. And when I went in, I didn't go in the treatment center with the thought that I would ever stop drinking alcohol. It was in St. Louis, around this time of year, you can have like a real severe Indian summer. And it was one that year. And they put me in the in a room behind the nurse's station in the treatment center because they wanted to check my vitals. This particular treatment center had been, you know, they were aware of my case. I had been in and out, put out, let back in, you know, just the whole deal. It took me about 6 years to really get the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was talking to somebody the other day, you know, I didn't get it right away. I was just back and forth, back and forth. And so they put me in the room behind the nurse's station, and as I was laying there, it seemed to me it was over 100 degrees in that room. But, you know, I for the first time, I just asked God to help me, you know, and that's really the short version of my story. I didn't see a white light or anything like Bill, but I did have enough peace to make it through that night. And it was probably the first time that I had been abstinent from anything for years, I mean, literally years. And things in my world or my perspective started to change with that one request. I remember the text at the treatment center. Let me just get up and walk that night, just to try to walk some of it off, and pulled out a meditation book. We sat down and read from it, and it just started. You know, I used to be the one in any kind of treatment setting or anything. I'd be the clown. I'd be the one to challenge the counselor. I had all the answers to, you know, all the questions. I was the clown. I'd always be with the losers. Whoever they were, that's who I associated with. But this time it was different. And, you know, a guy came in to the treatment center. It was on Monday night because it was, I remember he said I could be at home watching Monday night football. And he was from southeastern Missouri. And, you know, you think I might have an accent. He had an accent, you know. But, you know, When he discussed how he drank alcohol, I immediately related. And there was no, you know, in the treatment center, they told me, find somebody you identify with, you know, find somebody like you. But this guy was not like me. And some guys would come with him to the meeting on Mondays, and one of these guys walked up to me and asked me if I had a sponsor. I said, no, I don't have a sponsor. He said, well, I'll be your sponsor. Now, this guy was white. He was about 15 years younger than me. He had never left home, you know. But once again, it was one of those small spiritual experiences, and I just said, yeah. And that started a whole process. For the coming years, he would be, and his family embraced me just like I was a member of the family. He gave me an address for a meeting place where that was the home group of the guy who came in on Monday and these guys who followed him who were his sponsees. And as I said, St. Louis was still segregated as it is today. And I wasn't familiar with this part of the city, to be real truthful. And this is before GPS and all the rest of the stuff. But I found out where it was and I got over there. And when I got to the meeting, it looked a lot like this meeting. There were no other black people there but me. And the first job they gave me was the greeter. So here I am. I'm still having tremors. At the time, I weighed 147 pounds. So, you know, I'm standing at the door of the meeting, you know, shaking folks' hands. I didn't even have to put effort into the shake. It just automatically. I'm just having tremors, right? And the way that group, this is in the Bible Belt in Missouri, and the way they did the third step was on your knees in front of the group. So that's how I did my third step prayer. In a meeting like this, on my knees in front of the group. Me, who had been the, you know, rebellious militant all throughout my college, high school, everything, on my knees in front of a group of white people, turning my thinking and my life over to the care of God as I understood them. But, when I got up off my knees, I felt like I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I could go anywhere, and I had, you know, I had earned my seat. And before I could even get up good, you know, he was handing me my four-step stuff. And, you know, I learned from that. I was selfish. I was dishonest. I was fearful. You know, I was inconsiderate. And, you know, I just started to, you know, take the actions. You know, he simply told me, just do the opposite of whatever your mind tells you to do, do the opposite of that. And that's worked for me. It works for me now. You know, a lot of times when I'm in situations that are difficult to deal with, my mind will tell me, run, or will give me the wrong information. But just using something that simple. And, you know, I've always been a person to test something. You know, you couldn't pay me $1 billion to stand up here. Well, maybe $1 billion. But you couldn't pay me to stand here and say what I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous if I didn't feel it was true. You know, I was always the kind of person that would take you to, you know, I'm going to challenge anything you say. Unless, you know, until I find out that it's true for me. And in the process of participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out that it was true for me. I have, you know, 1,000 stories of how this program was demonstrated to me on a personal level. But I think the most important thing was with my father. One day, I had been in the program for 7 years or so, and like some of us, I had gotten involved in counseling. And I was listening to a speaker tape, and I was doing some paperwork, and the speaker was talking about how he made amends to his father. So I followed through. I called my sponsor. Sponsor said, well, give your dad a call. I called my father. I said, hey, Dad, how you doing? The next thing I heard was, I'm eating, and the dial tone. And what this guy had emphasized in the talk was, it's not about how you are received, but it's about cleaning off your side of the street. So I just started doing the things that a good son does, you know. I tried to stay in contact with him. I knew he loved barbecue. I loved to barbecue, so whenever I did, I'd take some barbecue to him, you know, to him. And just over a period of time, and this is maybe over a year or so, I began to be restored in terms of my relationship with my father, you know. And it opened up, it just opened the door. He showed me things like in the albums that he had in his house. And my mother and father had been divorced since I was two. And he'd share with me his experience in the marriage and what it caused him to do the things that he did. And basically, AA had given me my father back. And he had had another son, 15 years younger than me, by his second wife. And, you know, it gave me my brother. And I was the kind of person that if you mentioned anything about God, I would give you an extensive, comprehensive lecture on why God did not exist. You know, and I would always end it with my closer was, which was, you know, if God exists, then strike me dead right now. When I had a discussion with somebody that had any kind of spiritual or religious faith, you know. And today, the conscious awareness of a power greater than myself is the most important thing in my life. You know, a person that stumbled in here, that, you know, would have argued you from now on about the existence of God, now it plays a major role in my life. Carrying the message, I love to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous even more. My sponsor, it wasn't even a choice about getting involved in service. I mean, service is what we did, is what he taught me. And I was trying to think so I could be accurate, but I had previously, from my previous experience in New York, he told me, whenever you go to New York, visit the General Service Office. And, you know, every maybe 3 or 4 years, my wife and I would go to New York, we'd visit the General Service Office. And I got to know people. My sponsor eventually became a non-trustee director of the Grapevine Board, and eventually a trustee of the Grapevine Board. And he was always encouraged me to take the next step, whatever it was, in service. And the notice that the General Service Office was looking for a staff member was sent to our delegate. And my sponsor and delegate and I were all good friends, and she let me know. And I responded, and I got a response from the General Service Office, which was, not right now. And another notice came out, and I responded, and I got an answer from the General Service Board, General Service Office, I'm sorry. And that was right, you know, the same answer, not right now. So the third time comes around. I'm sitting at the office. Now I'm working as a manager of an educational, small educational television station. And I'm talking to my sponsor, and he asked me, did you follow through and send your application to become a staff member at the General Service Office? It's like, why would I do that? I already applied twice. You know, I got one interview, and then the second time I got a letter. So, you know, why would I do this? And he said, well, just if you still have all your electronic information, just forward it. And, you know, what harm does that do? And here I am. You know, and it's as much a statement about just sponsorship, because it was through sponsorship that I went to the General Service Office. It was through sponsorship that I followed my sponsor in his service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And here I am, and I'm here, and I wanted to tell my story. When I talked to Cindy, I wanted to be able to share that the people at the General Service Office, the staff members, are alcoholics, just like everybody in the audience. You know, I've heard people say several times, I make mistakes sometimes. Well, I don't know about that. I made a mistake one time, but I was mistaken. So, sorry about that. I couldn't resist. But, I just want to say that, you know, we're human beings. And it's no holier-than-thou type attitude at the office itself or amongst staff members. You know, there's one purpose, and that's try to serve the fellowship. You know, for me, I moved from St. Louis. I was very comfortable. I had a very comfortable home and all the material things. I moved to Harlem. I got a one-bedroom apartment with about triple the expense, you know, and it wasn't about, the move wasn't about trying to create anything for myself. The move was about service. And I can say that for a number of the people at the office that moved from all over the United States and gave up home groups and gave up family connections and gave up other things that, you know, that are important to us all in order to better serve. So I'm here all weekend. I've talked enough. I'm a good listener. I have some materials to you know, get contact information. I have some cards so I can share them with people here. If you have ideas about the app, ideas about the website design, ideas about things we haven't even considered at the General Service Office in terms of ways of better communicating with the fellowship. Please share them. Thank you.